Support for KBOO comes from our listeners. If you value independent media, go to kboo.fm and click donate. And thank you for supporting your community radio station.
Sponsor of the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park on North Brandon and North Kilpatrick Streets in Portland.
The Earth Day 2014 theme, Reverse Migration, will focus on local culture and businesses. Over 100 sustainable businesses and organizations, including KBOO Community Radio, will participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you're tuned to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM, also at kboo.fm, where you can go to become a member of this great community broadcasting station. Coming right up, it's Veterans Voice. Today, join Bill and Marvin as they interview Jerry Lemke, Vietnam veteran, professor, and author, and he'll be talking about his latest book, PTSD, Diagnosis, and Identity in Post-Empire America. At 10 o'clock, stay tuned for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, and at 10:15, Flashpoints features an interview with Ali Abunima and a tribute to the late journalist Robert Knight. At 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, host Lisa Loving speaks with Arielle Gore about her book, The End of Eve, a new book about her years spent caring for her dying mother. Thanks a lot for joining us this morning, and we're going to go right to Veterans Voice.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war. And without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 100.7 FM in Albany, Corvallis, Eugene, and also streaming on the World Wide Web at kboo.fm. You can also hear some of our past shows, if you'd like, by going to kboo.fm/Veterans Voice. Veterans Voice is one word. And you can hear some of our past shows on there. Then, pretty good ones, too, Bill, huh?
They're some awful good ones.
I'm Marvin. I'm here with Mr. Bill.
Good morning.
And today we're going to be talking with Jerry Lemke. And Jerry is the author of some really good books, The Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam, CNN's Tailwind, Inside Vietnam's Last Great Myth, and his book, Hanoi Jane, War, Sex, and Fantasies of Betrayal. And Jerry's new book is called PTSD, Diagnosis, and Identity in Post-Empire America. And we'll be talking to Jerry about that and a few other things that Jerry's done. And he's a, like he said, he's a Vietnam vet. He was in Vietnam, and he was a chaplain's assistant. And, you know, we've never talked to him about that, what that means, you know. So we'll talk to him about being a chaplain's assistant. And today, you know, it was really sad to hear that Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the wonderful writer, the author of really some great books, and 100 Years of Solitude, it should be on the top list of a lot of people's reading. Such a great book, and I hope people read that book and learn about, you know, South America and different places. But that is such a great book, and it was sad to hear that he died this morning, or this last night or this morning,
yeah.
And it was sad. And also, there's a lot of in the news lately about Agent Orange, and how veterans are still having to fight to get you know taken care of for diseases that was caused by Agent Orange, not only in Vietnam but also in Korea and in here in the States, and they have to fight for every inch of it, One guy just got some disability for Agent Orange, where he was saying that he, after the war, he helped along with some other Marines burying barrels and barrels and barrels of Agent Orange, and these guys came down with the diseases that you get from Agent Orange, and being denied their claims, you know, by the VA, and fighting for those claims, and he finally got his, but you know, a lot of guys like West. Like Wes, you know, Wes was a pilot on a C-123 way after the war. These planes were used to spray Agent Orange in Vietnam, and Wes was on our show.
He was on the show, right.
And he, you know, they're working really hard. And that stuff, boy, that's the war that keeps on giving, boy.
All wars keep on giving.
Even when that war ended, man, there's still lots of trouble. Never ends. And these guys, the people in Vietnam are still suffering from after effects of Agent Orange. And, you know, that's really, really a tough one. And my wife, Laurel, just got some good news the other day. She got a Fulbright Scholars Grant, which is her second one to go to Vietnam. The first one she used, we took Artist Repertory Theater and went and did play in Vietnam with the National Acting Company in Hanoi, Na Hat Kik Vietnam, and we did Midsummer Night's Dream. And we also did The Glass Menagerie.
Glass Menagerie, yeah.
Yeah, and that was all Vietnamese. That was really good.
Yeah, that was straight Vietnamese.
Straight Vietnamese, boy. And then we brought him here, and we toured the West Coast. And it was really, really good. And Laurel got another Fulbright Scholars Grant. And it's also to go back to Vietnam. And so she's going back. I'll go with her, and we're going back. And she's going to write a book about the actors and actresses that traveled down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and entertained their troops in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, because we know a bunch of them.
Yeah.
We know a bunch of those folks. But it's going to be really, really, really good. And she'll get to talk to a lot of the people in the South, the Viet Cong, the people that were fighting against Diem and fighting against Americans. She'll get to talk to a lot of those folks and find out about how they entertained their troops out in the fields fighting in the war, especially the women, the long-haired soldiers, the women fighters in the Viet Cong, how they entertained their troops and who did it and how their lives have been. And that should be really, really good.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that Laurel got that. Got that grant, and we're going to talk today to Jerry Lemke and his books. I mean, I've read them, The Spitting Image, Tailwind. I want to talk to him about Hanoi Jane. That was really good. Laurel really was interested in that one, and talk about that and his articles he's written. He's written articles, just so many. You know, Boston Globe, San Francisco Chronicle. National Catholic Reporter. He's been on NPR, and his book was featured in Sir No Sir with that anti-war, Vietnam anti-war with Jane Fonda and those folks.
Yeah.
He grew up in Northwest Iowa, has a degree from Augustine. I never heard of that one. I have to ask him about that college. University of Northern Colorado, and he's been here at University of Oregon. So he was drafted in 1968, and he served as a chaplain's assistant for the 41st Artillery Group. And he got out of the service, and he's presently associate professor of sociology emeritus at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester,
Massachusetts. And Jerry, welcome to the show.
Oh, good. Thanks to be with you. You did pretty well with that Worcester.
Worcester. I knew you was going to say that. I knew you were going
to. I'll help you with the Augustana.
Augustana, yeah.
Sioux Falls, South Dakota.
Wow. I never heard of that one, but they got a good guy by you.
Well, I hope they feel that way.
Oh, I'm sure they do. And your books are so amazing. I mean, the books, the spitting... The myth about spitting and the tailwind and the Hanoi Jane and this new book on PTSD was really interesting. And what got you to write this news book? Because I want to talk about the other books too. But what got you to write this book? Was there something that hit you off that you went, got it? And you needed to write this book?
Oh, my.
Yeah, I know.
That's a great question. You know, it really sprung off of the 1998 book, The Spitting Image. I had a chapter in there on that book. I had a chapter in there on PTSD. And I think what's common to both the spitting stories, the spitting image, the myth of the spit, and PTSD is that they both help create this idea that Vietnam veterans were treated badly when we came home from the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I can come back to that, but that in turn is really important because it helps construct this mythology that we lost the war because we were betrayed at home.
Mm-hmm.
See, this whole idea that Vietnam veterans, that we are somehow the victims of this war. Mm-hmm. And not so much the victims of the Vietnamese who beat us, but we're the victims of stuff that happened here on the home front. Liberals in Congress, radicals in the streets, so on and so forth. They're the ones who really inflicted the hurt on us. The spitting stories, of course, are the most graphic, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as the spitting stories go, when we came home from Vietnam, we were spat on by the anti-war movement. So that's sort of a grounding image for that mythology. But the other part of it, too, is that a lot of the PTSD claims, particularly those early on, would have it that coming home was such a traumatic experience. There you can find lots of quotes in books and lots in film, like the film Hamburger Hill,
mm-hmm.
That the real war was here at home. Who's the protagonist in the film Hamburger Hill? He has come home on leave, and now he has gone back to Vietnam. And he's gone back to Vietnam to fight the war that is really going on at home. So it was that battle on the home front that is imaged for us as the spitting stories, and in many ways as the trauma of coming home, and thus the PTSD. So I really got into writing the current book, the book on PTSD, because that topic bounced off or bounced out of the book on the spitting stories.
Yeah, I went back and looked at the first book as I was reading this book, and I think that the American people, who do you think led that type of thinking to make the people in general think about us, Jerry, think about us non-veterans as sickos and crazy in the head and can't
right.
be trusted? Was it who wrote those books? Who wrote those movies? Who wrote all of that about us?
Yeah. Well, thanks for giving me that, reminding me of that language, sickos and
kook yeah.
and so forth, because the real story is that lots of us came home from Vietnam and joined the anti-war movement.
Yes, we did.
We were very clear thinking.
Yeah.
There was nothing wrong with the way we were thinking.
Nope.
We joined the anti-war movement, and that was a real threat to the political establishment. Particularly the Nixon administration, but even beyond that, sort of the ideological and cultural establishment of the country was really uncomfortable with us having come home in that way. So what they did through popular culture, a lot of it occurred through film, and it began with the Nixon administration. It began with what Spiro Agnew, the vice president, in particular, began to say, that these guys who are in the streets with the anti-war movement, they're not real veterans. Or things to the effect that these guys who are in the streets have really been traumatized by their war experience. They maybe need some mental health services, but they shouldn't be taken seriously for their political action. So by words like that, and then the way Hollywood picked up on that, they recast us. They re-imaged us. They gave the American people a new representation of us, one that was consistent with that sort of mental health terminology and not so consistent with political terminology. So lots of people then began to think that, well, we're in the streets because it's cathartic. It's therapeutic. We're kind of working out, our stresses. We're working out our psychological difficulties that we had with the war and with coming home from the war. So I still, even after I've written all these books, I still get comments like that. People will say, they're not really arguing with me, but they're kind of bringing back their own thoughts on this, and they'll say, well, isn't it true, though, that, some guys were in the streets because they felt like like it was good for them, to have to do that? So it's an idea that really stuck with the American people, and it has really hung on. And I think it works to discredit those of us who came home from the war and joined the anti-war movement. And most importantly for me, and I'm sure this can go, into another discussion, but I think all of this came back when people began returning from Iraq, particularly, and there was a new generation of people who came back opposed to their war. They formed Iraq Veterans Against the War, but they had this imagery of trauma-stricken Vietnam veterans hanging over what they were doing. And it made it really, really hard for IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War, to get off the ground.
I want to talk to you about that. I'm glad you brought that up, because that's in your book here. And I got on this new book, and I got it circled, and Bill knows how I do this. I got all these marks around it, too.
He writes another book.
Yeah, I write a book in the size of a book. But
it's such a pleasure to be taken seriously by you and you know, having given it such a serious reading. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's a serious subject with us guys. And go ahead and talk about when the men and women came back from the first Gulf War, which never ended, you know, it's still going on. They got hung with the Gulf War syndrome. Gulf War syndrome is what made those guys crazy.
Right.
And so it leads right into what you were saying in here about these folks coming back from this latest fiasco. And you say in here it made it almost impossible for them to start a real anti-war movement. Talk about that. That really interested me.
Sure. You know, the best story I have about that is when Iraq Veterans Against the War did what they called base tours.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, a bus or maybe more than one bus that went around the country and stopped at places where there were military bases, but they stopped to meet with anti-war people in those cities and in those communities near those bases. So I went to one of those in New London, Connecticut, where the submarine base is. And I went there, and the bus tour pulled into a city park there, and there were local anti-war people there to meet and greet with the Iraq War Veterans Against the War. There was a literature table set up, and being a book writer, I went up to the literature table to see what kind of stuff, you know, that they had, and I got into a conversation with the fellow behind the table.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him how it was going, you know, how's the tour going? And he said, well, he said, it's been hard. He said, everywhere we go, he said, people just want to talk about PTSD, meaning the people from the towns and the cities. And he said, that's all people want to talk about. And then he waved his arms out, you know, toward the guys he was touring with, and he said, you know, do these guys look messed up to you?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course I said, no, they don't.
Yeah.
You know, they look like very clear-thinking, well-motivated, politicized war veterans, just like I was when I came back from the war in Vietnam. But sure enough, listening into some of the conversations that were going on in that park that night, and an awful lot of the conversations were about PTSD, you know, about war trauma and that sort of thing. So you see, that's it. It's hard to get the American public past that, and that's a hangover from the post-Vietnam War stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? That's because, as I said before, this stuff really caught on during the late 1970s and 1980s. The stuff I mean is the treatment of Vietnam veterans as mental health problems rather than as a political problem, which we were.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And that carried over. So you mentioned that first early term Gulf War syndrome.
Right.
And, of course, that was picked up from what was early on called Vietnam War syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was called in the early 70s before it became PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder,
right.
officially by the American Psychiatric Association in 1980. I don't know where now, I suppose I do know where Gulf War syndrome came from and when it was first invoked, but it surely was somebody reaching back, right, and borrowing that old term Vietnam War syndrome and simply putting it in play again, you know, after the 1990-91 incursion in the Gulf War.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really tough one. I remember when I came home and watching the, I didn't want to, you know, I went right to the anti-war movement, man. I went right to them, boy. Oh, I needed them, you know. And they never gave me a hard time, Jerry. The anti-war movement took us in and never said anything bad about us. The ones that were saying things bad about us was like these guys from Veterans of Foreign Wars, or American Legion, or all those groups, you know, who I can remember them calling us crybabies. You're a bunch of crybabies. You guys lost the war.
Exactly.
You know, you're the first ones that lost the war. You're a bunch of crybabies. And, you know, that. And no one ever spit on me. The closest I ever got to getting spit on was some World War II veteran getting in my face, screaming at me and slobbering on me, you know. It wasn't a Vietnam vet. And it wasn't the peace movement. It was these guys that were blaming us for losing a war.
Absolutely. There was a lot of that. I experienced some of that myself. I was active in Vietnam Veterans Against the War in the Denver area, and we had some of those encounters. But the other thing that you're saying there is we were embraced by the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
They became our friends. They tried to recruit us into the anti-war movement, far be it from being hostile to us or, you know, being or spitting on us.
Oh, yeah, I know. They
anything like that. But the other thing, maybe more to the point here
of
my latest book, you know, they didn't treat us as damaged goods either.
Mm-mm.
I mean, they didn't, you know, there was none of that. Right on through the end of the war in Vietnam and when the anti-war movement then began to disband, but I didn't experience anything like that either. There was no, I suppose there were words like, gee, it must have been tough, or things like that, but most of what the anti-war people were interested in was the resistance activities that were going on within the military.
Yes.
Certainly by the late 1960s, and then on, you know, into the end of the U.S. Presence in 1973, that's what people were interested in, our own resistance activities within the military.
Yeah, and they. I don't know if you know about the peace committee, the guys that were POWs in the North who set up the peace committee, you know, and. Bob Chenoweth is a really good friend of mine, and he was one of the main guys in the peace committee. In fact, he and I went back to Vietnam last year. Didn't we go back last year?
Yeah.
Bob and I went back last year, and it was so interesting.
I'll bet.
But he talks about that also. He talks about when he came home where he got involved with the anti-war movement. And he toured with Jane Fonda and all those people in the anti-war movement and Tom Hayden and all those folks and how he was treated in comparison how they were treated by the so-called good guys, you know.
Right.
The other, you know, they were considered traitors and all this by everybody else. And Bob talks about that, and he talks about you know how he was treated by the other folks, and when they were in the Philippines, Bob was talking about they had the peace committee guys separated from the other people, and it was really interesting. And he said that all the doctors and the nurses and folks would come up to him and say, you know, we think just like you guys do, you know,
right?
We believe just like you guys believe, you know.
Yeah.
And so they were like being really treated different by the government, and then by the regular troops who supported them.
Another interesting thing about the returned POWs is that if there was any experience in Vietnam that would have been traumatic for me, or would have produced post-war symptoms of trauma, flashbacks, and so forth.
Yeah, I wouldn't talk about that.
It would have been being imprisoned in Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would have been a horrific experience for me. And yet, I went through again. I've been through the POW memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
There's 30 some of those, and I for different reasons, I've been through them now. Some of them more than a couple of times.
Yeah, you're like me, boy. I do too.
You know, I went back to look to see whether any of these guys write about that as a traumatic experience. And the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they write about it as a, well, sort of small-T trauma, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they write about it as being a terrible experience. Some of them write about torture and so forth. But they don't, none of them use the vocabulary or the mental health lexicon associated with PTSD.
Yes, that's true.
It's just not there.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these memoirs come out even after 1980. Quite a few of them do, actually.
Yeah.
After 1980, when PTSD has already been, officially recognized by the American Psychiatric Association. So it's just like, again, my point there is, you know, when we came back from Vietnam in the early 70s, we weren't hit with that label. We
mm-hmm.
weren't treated that way. And the POWs were not either, and that was not part of their representation of themselves, right, after they came back, as they wrote in their own memoirs. So this whole PTSD thing, which has now become the way in which America talks about certainly Vietnam veterans, and has now become the way it talks about people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, all of that is a very belated post-Vietnam War phenomenon, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I am so interested in it. It's really a cultural thing. And that's the way I write about it, which is not in any way to say that war cannot be traumatic.
Oh, yeah.
Right? As I've already said, I mean, with the POW thing.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness.
Yeah, right.
I don't know how they came out as well as they did.
Boy, me
right?
either.
But that's a whole... There's a gap there between the real experience of war, all of its horror, all of that, and the way we now think about that, the way we have come to reimagine that within this mental health language, this mental health terminology, this mental health way of thinking about it. There's a gap there somehow,
mm-hmm.
someplace. And that's really what I'm interested in. That's what the new book is about.
Yeah, definitely about it. Bill had something he wanted to ask you, Jerry.
Yeah, sure. Jerry, I was watching a discussion about this very thing, and one of the commentators said that the people that seemed to be most badly affected by PTSD were mentally unbalanced, or I'm paraphrasing, before they were even entered into the Army. And I've been puzzling over that for such a long, since I heard it, regarding what does that say about the society?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And you're, the point you bring up is absolutely a very good point, and that's borne out in the medical journal literature that tries to get at, as these people do, to put it in kind of mental science, medical science terminology. They're interested in what best predicts something like a PTSD diagnosis. What in these people's background is the best predictor of whether or not they end up with a PTSD diagnosis?
Yeah.
And the best predictor is not combat experience.
Hmm.
It's not combat experience. And one of the really, really good predictors is pre-military experience. It's what people bring into the military. It's their growing up experience. One article, even a fairly recent article, says that it's parenting. It's the kind of parenting that they got is the most important variable. So that's really cranking it down.
Yeah, that's
specific.
Wow.
Right? But that is one of the best. That is one of the best. One of the best predictors. And I mean, going way back in this book, I just learned so much writing this book because I went back and looked at shell shock from World War I.
Right.
And what doctors were seeing already by the end of World War I is that people who had never been to the front were more likely to be exhibiting symptoms that came to be associated with shell shock than those people who had been to the front.
Huh.
And that was a shocker.
Yeah.
Right. And it was one of the things that led to the discrediting of shell shock as a diagnostic category by the end of the war. Now, run that forward. Some of you, some listeners might remember a book by Peter Born, was his name. One of the first books that was written about what was then called Vietnam War Syndrome. It came out in, I think, 1972 or 1973.
Wow.
And he was a psychiatrist in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. He was an in-military psychiatrist. And he wrote, based on his findings, that psychiatric casualties, which was then the terminology, you know, that he was using, were more likely among what was we then called a rear echelon soldiers, more likely to occur among people, soldiers in Vietnam, who were in non-combat roles.
Wow.
Psychiatric casualties more likely to be among non-combat people than combat people.
What was his... go ahead, because I'm wondering what would be the catalyst for that? Guilt?
Well, it's you kind of stumped me. I don't have a quick answer to that.
That's all right.
But it's not... we know psychiatric problems can appear for people for lots of reasons.
Right.
There's many of them among our friends, right?
Oh, yeah.
Among our relatives. And it's not always, probably most time, it doesn't have anything to do with a traumatic experience. So
yeah.
You would assume the answer to your question would be, well, for the same reasons that...
Yeah, I know. It's a tough one.
What's that?
That's a tough one.
People who were not in Vietnam in 1968 or those years were getting psychiatric diagnoses. So there's a certain number of people in Vietnam who are getting those diagnoses, too, which has nothing to do with the fact that they're in Vietnam and nothing to do with the fact that they're, you know, they're in combat because they weren't in combat.
Yeah,
the usual ordinary Americans, you know, who have some kind of psychiatric problem.
Yeah,
that's the answer.
Yeah, I was in a group at the vet center one time, and there was two guys in there. One had been a clerk in Vietnam at the 90th Replacement. And the other guy had been in grave registrations, and those guys were damaged. Those guys were really damaged. And about Vietnam, the guy that was the clerk typist, he was telling us about how guilt he had that he felt that he was sending us to die when he got to stay in the 90th Replacement, which was not safe, but safe. And he had so much guilt, Jerry, about that, about sending guys to their death. And then the guy from the grave registrations, boy, that would have been a tough job. He was always afraid. He talked about having these horrible dreams where these guys would come back and talk to him, you know, and say, well, this wasn't my leg, you know? Or what happened to my arm? You know, this isn't my arm, and he felt so bad about that he had failed, you know, failed guys in Vietnam. And boy, I tell you what, I know a lot of combat vets, but boy, these two guys who weren't combat vets, boy, they were really, really in trouble. They were
trouble. Certainly, that can be part of the answer to the question you asked, right? Well, you know, guys who are in a rear area. Not in combat, you know. How could they have problems? I mean, there you go.
Yeah,
there's a couple of answers to that. One, which would be easily understood for me, would be working in graves registration.
Oh yeah.
Although, you know, there are people who work People who work in medical fields and, you know, work in funeral homes, mm. so on and so forth all the time, and don't necessarily experience that traumatically, of course.
Yeah, it just,
so,
yeah.
Again, you know, part of the question is, well, another question is, yeah. well, who does and who doesn't,
mm-hmm.
right? Most people worked in grave registration and, you know, didn't come home with any
right.
problem.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the fellow you talked to. He did. Wouldn't surprise me if you look closer at that really his problem stemmed not from working in graves registration, but maybe something in his background.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. There was probably something when he was a younger kid, something happened to
yeah.
him.
What you don't want to say is that his problem is not real.
Right.
You see, you don't want to say that about the clerk typist or about the fellow in graves registration.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to say that, right? But you also want to say that we need to, well, we certainly medical people, mental health people, need to be about the business of getting to what the real problem is.
Right.
And one of the problems I think we have in America is that we're sort of broad brushing a whole lot of men who come back from war or just come out of the military who have problems, and they're being broad brushed with the military experience explanation for their problems,
mm-hmm.
which is then covering over or missing what their real problems might be.
Yeah.
You see.
Yeah,
and,
I agree with you on that. Boy,
you see,
I agree
that's
with you.
The thing. I think a lot of it, and I've written about this, you know, in a couple of different places, but there's a kind of crisis of masculinity in America, and there's a lot of men who are not feeling good about themselves as men, a lot of insecurity, a lot of self-esteem kind of problems, and one of the ways of covering over that, even for the individual, or trying to grab something to make them feel better, is an inflated sense of military accomplishment, which lead them, and I'm sure you picked up that this is a key part of my book,
right?
Can lead them to grasping for some kind of medical identity
mm-hmm.
out of that. I mean, the subtitle of my book is Diagnosis and Identity. Diagnosis and Identity.
And Identity, right.
Actually, the preferred subtitle I had was Diagnosis or Identity. but the editor kind of toned it down a little bit and put the word. Because, and the punchline on that is that for some men, the medical diagnosis of PTSD or TBI has become a kind of badge of honor,
mm-hmm.
a kind of way of saying, oh, look, you know, if we're in a conversation in a bar and I tell you I'm a Vietnam veteran and you express skepticism about that, and so I feel like I need to flash my credential to you and say that I am the real deal. One way of doing that is to, well, one way, of course, would be to pull out my Purple Heart.
There you go.
Right, and say, look, you know, there's my Purple Heart. Well, if I don't have a Purple Heart, I might still be able to say to you, you know, look, I'm really screwed up. I have nightmares. I have flashbacks. Then maybe tell you some story about my flashback. Chances are you aren't going to push that any further.
Right.
You know, chances are you're going to say, oh, this guy is the real deal,
mm-hmm.
right? You kind of accept that as a credential, and it's a kind of a credential that then stops the interrogation,
right?
Because you don't want to upset this person. You certainly don't want to challenge the authenticity, right, of what they're telling you. I mean, that would be really distasteful. I would
think so too. But you know, when you brought back that, when you came a little while back, you were talking about flashbacks, and
sure.
one chapter, chapter 5, I think it was in your book, Flashbacks, War Trauma, Refashioned for PTSD. talk. That was so interesting. Talk about that. I wish we had a couple more hours, but talk about that. That really interested me. I never thought about it.
Well, one of the dangers in these short conversations is that it's I can say things trying to look for the shorthand of it, and then it comes out maybe not as complete as I want it, but. I think the main thing there is that, again, I'm drawing on the medical literature on this. Flashbacks are probably the main symptom in defining PTSD as a diagnostic category. Otherwise, PTSD is really a bundle of other things. Depression, anxiety, panic attacks. Sleep disorders, things like that, that are diagnosable and treatable, right on their own terms. The one thing though that's different about PTSD is the flashbacks, although that's also very closely related to the sleeping disorders. But the medical literature, the critical medical literature, right? The people who are maybe skeptical about something like flashbacks, and there are these people. There are psychiatrists who are skeptical, and so I draw a lot on their literature, and I say that, well, one of the things skeptics are saying is that a flashback mostly is just a memory, right? Or they'll ask the question. What's the difference between a memory and a flashback? When does a memory become a flashback? When is it normal, and when is it pathologized? When is it treated as a medical problem, as a flashback? And these people who write about that question or those questions say, well, it's pretty subjective, right? It's pretty much a judgment call by the doctor, by the mental health professional, and of course it's dependent on what the patient is giving them. So it becomes almost a kind of self-diagnosis. What else do you have to go on?
Yeah, right. Right?
You're not part of my memories or my dreams or my nightmares or my flashbacks. So it's kind of up to me how I present that to you. I mean, anybody, I think, I don't know, anybody who was in Vietnam certainly has memories of Vietnam. I don't think a day goes by but what I don't think about Vietnam or something that happened in Vietnam.
Yep.
I'm quite sure that I could present myself to a mental health worker, and without really exaggerating very much, right? Say that I have flashbacks, right? And their memories. At least one article also treats flashbacks, and I quote this, I know, in the book, maybe more than once actually, that they're as much flashbacks are as much imagination as memory. And when I saw that, I found that quote when I was working on The Spitting Image. When I saw that, I thought, oh, my God. Imagination, memory. Because now that puts into play film, novels, myth, legends, a lot of what I write about. And people who've written a lot about PTSD, they do a lot of stuff. They look at the content of these flashbacks, and then they say, and I do a bit of this, okay, where might this have come from besides an experience in Vietnam? It's a scene in a movie.
Yeah.
So maybe this guy saw the movie and sort of built this into his own memory as something that happened to him. Now, we know that lots of people do that, not just war veterans, right? There's a term in the literature called prosthetic memory, right? It's when we take something else, and we add it on to our memory.
Mm.
And we build it into our memory. Mm-hmm. So much so that sometimes it gets lost.
Yeah. It becomes a part.
Yeah.
It truly becomes our memory.
Mm-hmm.
I get asked this a lot. People say, well, so are guys making this up? Are guys lying? No, not necessarily.
No,
they're not lying.
Mm-mm. No, I've had my own memory checked a few times. You know, holy cow, you're right.
Your own memory checked.
That didn't happen, did it? None of our memories are fixed.
Right, right, that's true.
All of our memories are pliable, they're plastic, they're all constantly in revision. And the more often we revisit our memories, the more often we pull them out of storage.
Yeah, yeah.
Put them into conversation, or we see a film, and that pulls something out of our memory. Then when we restore our memory, it goes back in changed.
Yeah.
Right? It's not going to go back in the same. It's going to go back in altered by what we have seen, altered by the conversation that we've had.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of long-winded on that.
but it makes sense. It does make sense. And I think people will understand that.
Yeah, all of that has to do with flashbacks.
Right.
All of that has to be talked about when we talk about what flashbacks are. We talk about the validity of them, you know, as a symptom.
Mm-hmm.
Right. See, there's the key word, right? When does a memory become a
symptom? Right.
That's part of it.
Right. You know, Jerry's book is PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. And it's really a good book, Jerry. And I hope that when you write more books, you keep in contact with us because we definitely, your books make a lot of sense. But we don't have much time, but I want to ask you really, really quick. And I know we don't have much time, but why did they pick Jane Fonda? But when Jane Fonda did what she did, the war was over.
Yeah.
The war was over. There were hardly any troops in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, the POWs were coming home and everything, but they picked her. Why?
Well, I mean, the big single answer to that is gender, sex and gender. A woman. Women betrayal figures throughout history play very prominently.
Mm.
You can go back to the Bible. To Delilah in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
Tokyo Rose, you know, the whole thing. So that's part of it. The other part of it was that the movie roles that Fonda played. Fonda had a kind of warrior woman identity because of the film Barbarella.
Yeah.
Now, see, most people want to say, well, it's the sex kitten, mm-mm, part of that. And I say, no, it isn't.
You're right. It's not
that. It's the warrior woman part of that. And then other films that she did like that, the kind of androgynous images that she plays in a lot of these films, including Barbarella. Is Barbarella straight, sexually straight, or not in that film? There's a lot of sexual ambiguity in that film, and a lot of it in a lot of films, including Coming Home.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. In that film.
Yeah, with Coming Home, I can really see where these right wingers would go after her on the movie Coming Home. You know, and so.
But she has her first satisfying sexual experience with a man who is paralyzed from the waist down.
Right. And I always thought that was interesting in the movie that they did that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always thought that was really interesting and how she did that. Jerry, we're about out of time, and I want to thank you so much for coming on. And I want to thank you for all the books that you've done. And this last book, PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America, is a very good book, and I hope people read it. And I hope, you know, when you got something coming on or articles, send me an email so I can check them out.
Well, I sure will. Such a pleasure to
it's our pleasure
to be with you, because of your preparation and and your awareness of all these issues.
Okay,
thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you, buddy. Talk to you later.
Right, bye.
Bye. You know, Jerry brings up a lot of points, and the one thing that, by reading his book, he's not saying that PTSD isn't real. You know, he's saying that PTSD is real and that it is a problem and that it's got to be taken care of, and that men and women in war are so affected by war, you know, what happens in a war.
Oh, certainly.
To them. And he's trying to, you know, get all this other garbage that's added into PTSD and get to the heart of the problem, and to get to you know, because all the time, you know, they're always adding stuff in, and PTSD is real.
And people react differently to experiences.
Yeah.
And you can't put all of in the same
boat.
Slot.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's talking about that. I mean, he didn't, like he said, he didn't have really enough time to really go into it and explain everything, but he's making the point that other people are telling us what we got.
Yeah.
You know, other people, all these thinking heads and everything are telling us what's wrong with us.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He hates that, you know, and he hates that. So they're telling us, you know, they're adding all this stuff onto us. And, you know, we know what's wrong with us. We know what happened to us in a war. We know how that affected us and how it affected our families, you know. And for them to be adding this other stuff on it just makes it worse. It makes, you know, it makes people, when you say, I have PTSD, that you're crazy.
Yeah, it doesn't justify
it. Yeah, you're crazy, or I don't feel safe around you, or whatever. I've heard that 1,000 times. And if you look, whenever there's something going on with veterans, Vietnam veterans, the Gulf War veterans, or whatever is going on, what is the first person that the TV station goes for? The craziest looking guy.
Yeah.
They always go for the craziest looking guy.
The one that's unkempt.
Yeah, the guy that's unkempt or whatever. They'll always go right to that guy. You know, and then that's brushing us, like Jerry said, it's brushing us all with this brush, saying that we're all like that, and we're not. You know, this guy, the guy has a problem, and he needs help. He really needs help. He needs to be taken care of, because the government and this country caused him to be like he is.
Right.
And he needs to be taken care of. But he doesn't need to be as called a bum, a crazy man, or whatever. And he definitely doesn't need to have a camera shoved in his face and a microphone put in his face, because he can't deal with it. You know, PTSD is a real problem, and our men and women coming home now are needing help, and
you
they
bet.
Need help bad.
You bet.
And it's, you know, it's a problem, and it's a bigger problem that's not, this government is hiding from us. So we're going to be back at 9 a.m. on May 16th here on Veteran Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. And we'll be in the spring fundraising by then. And we'll be on the air that day. Will be fundraising day. So we'll be on the air and hoping that more and more listeners come and join us on Veterans Voice and become a member of the KVU family. Yeah, the name, Jerry, his name is Jerry Lemke, L-E-M-B-C-K-E, Jerry Lemke. It's called PTSD, Diagnosis and Identity in Post-Empire America. And he has lots of other articles out there. And he like I said, he's a Vietnam vet, and he'll help, you know, explain a lot of stuff. And we'll be back next month, May 16th, at 9 a.m., and there it is.
And we want to say thank you to our wonderful engineer.
There we go, Tammy.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British Wars.
band started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. Always the young to fall. Now look at all we want with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sold Out Music Festival happening now until April 20th at venues all over Portland. The Sold Out Music Fest seeks to bring together people of all generations and backgrounds to celebrate the music that helps to bind our collective culture together. Legends of New Orleans jazz, the luminaries of Brooklyn hip-hop, the queen of modern soul music, and more are performing together under one banner. Bands, venues, bios, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.